Good morning. In last quarter's study, we began studying the lives of Saul, David, and Solomon, kings of Israel. And this quarter, we'll continue our study of that United Kingdom, the part two of the United Kingdom, looking at the latter part of David's life and then the life of Solomon. We'll also look at the wisdom literature, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. But what I'd like to do before we begin our study, and we'll be looking at 2 Samuel chapters 13 and 14, not all of chapter 14, but you can be turning over there if you'd like. But what I'd like to do before we get into the study is to just do some select highlights of the part one of the United Kingdom. So let me ask you some questions and go over some things. You know, let's understand that Israel having a king was not God's original intent, was it? You might say because of the hardness of their heart, he gave them a king. They wanted to be like the nations round about them, so he gave them a king. But when God did give them that king, those kings were authorized and approved of God. Saul, David, and Solomon were approved of God. And I want to draw a lesson from that. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, several verses in 1 Samuel chapter 8, you know, when we think about God's original intent, we might say, in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 4, 7, and 9, you know, people came to Samuel and they described that they wanted to be like the nations round about them. And in verse 7, God told Samuel, they've not rejected you, they've rejected me. But he says in verse 9, hearken therefore unto their voice. Give them what they want. Here's God's original intent, that he be their king. Give them what they want, but declare to them what that king will be like and what he will do. But in 1 Samuel chapter 10, in verse 24, Samuel said to all the people, see him, talking about Saul, see him whom the Lord hath chosen. Just kind of give you an illustration. In Mark chapter 10, just to kind of illustrate those three points of here's God's original intent, here's what he allowed now. He changed what his intent was to an allowance, but then what he allowed was authorized and approved. In Mark chapter 10 and verse 5, Jesus, in talking with the Jews of his day, he said about divorce, he said, for the hardness of your heart, he wrote you this precept. There in Deuteronomy 24 and verse 1, God allowed them a divorce for uncleanness. Now, that wasn't God's original intent. But for the hardness of their heart, he allowed that. And when he did, Deuteronomy 24 and verse 1 was authorized and approved of God. It was a change from God's original intent. But it was authorized and approved of God. Just using that to illustrate our point here, in 2 Samuel, in 2 Samuel chapter 8, and also in chapter 10, they wanted a king. God said, give it to them. And when he did, when he changed from going from him being their king to giving them Saul, Saul was authorized and approved of God. And here's more of the point why I stress that. We need to understand the seriousness of the kings that God gave them and that he gives us. Do you remember what David said when he had the opportunity to take Saul's life in 1 Samuel chapter 26? He said it three times. Do you remember what he said? When David had the opportunity to take Saul's life in 1 Samuel chapter 26, in verse 9, verse 11, and verse 23, what did he say? Yeah, I'm not going to lift up my hand against God's anointed. Like we saw there in 1 Samuel chapter 10, Samuel said, see, him whom the Lord has chosen. David said, I'm not going to lift up my hand against the Lord's anointed. Who can do that and be without guilt? Do you remember in 2 Samuel chapter 1, 2 Samuel chapter 1, what the young man came to David, told him about the battle where Saul and Jonathan had died. Do you remember what David said to him when he related what he had done? 2 Samuel chapter 1, do you remember what David said to that young man who came back from the battle, told him about Saul dying, Jonathan dying? What did he say? Right. He said, 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 14, "How were you not afraid to stretch forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" So yeah, that wasn't God's original intent for them to have a king. For you might say, we say in a manner of speaking, for the hardness of their heart, he allowed it. He suffered it. But when he changed and he gave them what he gave them, that king Saul was authorized and approved of God. And David said, rightly so, "I'm not going to lift up my hand against the Lord's anointed." Here's the application. In Romans 13, verse 1, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God." 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 13 and 14, "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well." So we have a similar injunction that we need to honor and obey and respect and follow the powers that be. Romans 13, verse 1, 1 Peter 2, verse 13 and 14. So it doesn't matter where that power is. It's ordained of God. The authorities in the U.S., they're ordained of God. The authorities in Italy, they're ordained of God. In China, you know, they're ordained of God. Wherever in Europe, wherever they are ordained of God. "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers." So, I'll revolt. I'll destroy. No, we need to have David's attitude. In review again, God gave David rest from all his enemies. 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 1, verse 9, verse 11. God gave them rest from all his enemies. And, understand that David would act on God's authority. Like in 2 Samuel chapter 5, in verses 17 through 25. David a number of times would ask God, "Shall I go up and smite?" So he acted with authority from God when he did what he did. But so then he wanted to do something for God. God gave him rest from all of his enemies. He was acting under God's authority, and he wanted to do something for God. You remember what he wanted to do in 2 Samuel chapter 7 when he said, "I dwell in a house of cedar. The ark of God dwells within curtains." What did David want to do for God? Build him a house, right? But then what did God want to do for him? You remember in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 11 and verse 16, God wanted to make him a house, right? He said, "The Lord telleth thee that he shall make thee an house," in verse 16, "and thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever." So David wanted to build God a house. No. David, I'm going to build you a house. I'm going to establish your throne forever. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 30, you remember how that the apostle Peter was relating how that God, or that David, as a prophet, foretold that God would raise up Christ to sit on his throne. So, and he's speaking about that. Peter described and explained that David meant at Jesus' resurrection. So God raised Jesus from the dead, set him on his throne. But he was of David's lineage. We read about that also in Psalm 132, verse 11. But so God was going to establish David's throne forever. Jesus would come through his lineage, and God would establish his throne. Also in review, what was it that led to the troubling of David's household? In 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 10 through 15, what was it that led to the troubling of David's house? Bathsheba. All right. And in 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 10 and 11, God told David several consequences, three or four consequences, depending on how you want to divide them up. But in 2 Samuel 12, verses 10 and 11, here are the consequences. David, your sin, here are the consequences. "The sword shall never depart from your house." And what we're seeing, what will be seen in 2 Samuel 13 and 14 and beginning in our study in the part two of the United Kingdom, what we're seeing is this being fulfilled. "The sword shall never depart from your house." In verse 11, I'll raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and I'll take your wives and give them to your neighbor before your eyes. And the third thing is, the child that is born unto you will die. So here's the consequences of your sin. And the one we want to focus on in our study, and remember in our study, is the sword shall never depart from your house. There's a consequence of sin. You know, but I would just like to make a sidestep. Let me check my time. I would like to make a sidestep on the applications. And about the child shall die. You know, what is sin? Sin's a transgression of God's law, right? And the wages of sin is death, spiritual death, right? What if someone were to die without sin? What would their state be? When someone dies without sin, what is their state before God? They're safe. They're right. They're safe. In Jeremiah 19, verses 4 and 5, he describes there about how that Israel had degraded to the point of offering their children to idols. But he describes them as innocent. These children are innocent. They're without sin. They're safe before God. You know, and maybe to give you more of an idea where I'm going with this and just taking the opportunity to make this point, skeptics look at the scriptures and they look at events like God, you know, having, say, a young child destroyed. But you know, heaven is going to be filled with those who were innocent. So many young children die. You know, God has a reason for what he does. And in this case with David and Bathsheba's son, we see the reason. You know, God said, you've caused the enemies of God to blaspheme, the child will die. You despise me, David. The child's going to die. You know, what brought grief to David really resulted in ultimate bliss to the child, didn't it? He's innocent. He's safe. He'll be with God. And here's the point to the skeptics. You know, our agreement with God's actions, when we're looking in these Old Testament studies, we're covering a lot of things that maybe, you know, are a lot different than they are under the New Covenant law. But our agreement with God's actions, say under the Old Covenant, what God did with, say genocides and things of that nature, our agreement with God's actions has no bearing over his existence, does it? You know, there's people all over this globe that exist, but we don't understand them, we don't agree with them, and we don't believe what they believe, but they still exist. You know, existence and agreement are two different things. You know, you may not like the God of the Bible, but what you don't like doesn't prove that he does not exist. It may just simply be, and I believe it is, that you don't understand. And that's what we need to do, is seek to understand God's reasons, God's will. But remember that a person's existence or a being's existence and agreeing with what that being does and teaches are two different things. One does not disprove, agreement does not disprove existence. But we see the God's reason. Another point in our study. Remember that we're studying the lives of those living under the Old Testament law. In Hebrews 7, verse 12, for the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law. The law changed. Romans 7, verse 4, we're dead to the law by the body of Christ. We don't live under the law that said offer animal sacrifices or use instruments of music or whatever, worship on the Sabbath day. We're under a different law. Let's remember that as we're going through this Old Testament period study. Colossians 2:16, let no man therefore judge you. And he lists off a number of things, including the Sabbath days. You know, when we look at David's good examples or anyone's good examples in the Old Testament, we need to understand and remember we can follow their faith, but not their law. The law changed, Hebrews 7, verse 12. Let's not forget that. Let's not forget that. We can follow their faith, but we're not following their law. They believed and obeyed God under the law they were given. We can follow their example of faith and believe and obey God under the law that we're given. But the law is different. The law changed, Hebrews 7, verse 12. Now looking at getting to the main point of our lesson, any comments? In today's passage in 2 Samuel chapters 13 and 14, Amnon violates his sister Tamar. Just an overview of the two chapters. He violates his sister Tamar. Absalom kills his brother Amnon for what he did. And then he flees to Syria. And then after 3 years, Joab convinces the king David to bring his son Absalom back home. Again, that's just an overview of our lesson this morning. And I think it would be good as we're studying these characters, the main characters in our lesson this morning, Absalom, Amnon, Tamar, Joab, and David, and Jonadab, to get maybe, it helps me a little bit, to get in my mind a little bit of the family tree, David's family tree. David, and that's what I have on the board here, just I couldn't really find a family tree that I wanted to use, so I just made a text format for us, just focusing in on just a few people of David's household. So here's David, his brother Shimeah, and his sister Zeruiah. David had like at least 18 wives and concubines, eight main wives, we might say, and then 10 concubines, maybe more. And of David's wives, he bore Amnon, of one wife, and then Absalom and Tamar were born of another wife. Shimeah, his brother, had a son, Jonadab, and that was Amnon's buddy, and so David's nephew. Zeruiah, David's sister, had Joab, the captain, and so here's another nephew of David. Well, maybe I'll leave that on the screen for now. In looking at in our study this morning at 2 Samuel chapter 13 and 14, we'll just look at some highlight verses from these chapters. Here in chapter 13, just prior to this, David and Joab took the city of Waters, the city of the Ammonites, and then David returned to Jerusalem and Judah. And then we see an account of Amnon and how that he loved his sister Tamar. In verse 1 it says, "And it came to pass after this that Absalom, the son of David, had a fair sister whose name was Tamar, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her." And so his buddy Jonadab, David's nephew, came in and he sees Amnon's countenance and he asks him what's going on. And Amnon says, you know, he wanted to be with his sister Tamar. And so Jonadab hatches this plan that he can be with his sister. And in verse 5, it says, "And Jonadab said unto him, Lay thee down on thy bed, make thyself sick, and when thy father comes to see thee, say unto him, I pray thee, let my sister Tamar come and give me meat, and dress the meat in my sight, that I may see it, and eat it at her hand." And so Amnon receives this counsel from Jonadab, and so there's this plan that he can has to be with Tamar, and so he starts working on that plan. So he lays himself down in verse 6, calls David, and David comes to see him. David inquires, and so Amnon tells him what he wants. And in verses 6 through 14, in the next section, Tamar comes and makes food for Amnon. And then what does Amnon do? Well, he tells everyone to go away from his presence. In verse 11, "And when she had brought them unto him to eat, the food that she had made for Amnon, he took hold of her and said unto her, Come, lie with me, my sister. And she answered him, Nay, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing ought to be done in Israel. Do not thou this folly. And I, whither shall I cause my shame to go? And as for thee, thou shalt be as one of the fools in Israel. Now therefore I pray thee, speak unto the king, for he will not withhold me from thee." So she's reasoning with Amnon. Tamar's reasoning with Amnon. He'd have none of that reasoning. "Howbeit he would not hearken unto her voice, but being stronger than she, forced her and lay with her." You know, this was Tamar's advice. You know, just speak to the king. He'll give me to you. You know, whether that would have there's some things in this study this morning maybe you can help me with, maybe you can give me some advice and maybe point some passages out to me, but I'm not sure about Tamar's advice. Would that really have been acceptable under the law? I don't know. In Leviticus chapter 18 and verse 11, Leviticus 18 and verse 11, we see some points in the law, the Old Testament law about incest. It didn't look like one could marry their brother or sister. And so, you know, maybe was she just seeing the lesser of two evils in her mind, or maybe was she just trying to deter Amnon in some way from the situation, wasn't thinking through what she said. Maybe she didn't know the law. I don't know. In verses 15 through 19, and I would welcome your comments on any of this as we're going through the lesson. In verses 15 through 19, Amnon then told Tamar to leave, and he bolts the door behind her. She's again trying to reason with Amnon, saying that this sin of having her leave is worse than the first. But he wouldn't listen to Tamar, cast her out, locked the door behind her. Tamar went away weeping with ashes on her head. In verses 20 through 22, Absalom her brother said unto her, "Hath Amnon thy brother been with thee? But hold now thy peace, my sister. He is thy brother. Regard not this thing." So Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. But when King David heard of these things, he was very wroth. And Absalom spake unto his brother Amnon neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar. And so Absalom found out what Amnon had done to his sister, but said nothing to him, good or bad, about it. And Absalom counseled Tamar not to speak of the incident, not to regard it. And so she stayed in the house of Absalom. And we see from the account also that David was very angry. Excuse me. From what we know later from Jonadab, why might Absalom have advised Tamar not to speak about the incident? If you've read into the lesson and you know what Jonadab later told David about Absalom and his plans, what do we know about that? Why might Absalom have told Tamar, "Just don't say anything"? Maybe his vengeance, planning vengeance. You know, basically, Tamar, don't do anything about this. I'll take care of it, you might say. I'll take out vengeance. He's not explicitly saying that in the text, but we know evidently from what Jonadab said that that was his plan. At least that's what Jonadab said. And now, oh, go ahead. Right. Right. Good point. Okay, so Absalom, and good point that Absalom was taking care of his sister. Amnon wasn't going to. Absalom was going to take care of his sister. I'm not sure about the application of Old Testament law in these events. I understand, and I was looking at several passages, someone might say, well, because of Deuteronomy 22, verses 25 and 26. Deuteronomy 22, and you can look over there at this account. Deuteronomy 22, verses 25 and 26. You know, here was the death penalty for an attacker. But that, I began looking at that, and it says that if the woman is betrothed. I don't know that Tamar was. But then I looked down in verses 28 and 29 of Deuteronomy 22. So if a man find a damsel that's a virgin, which is not betrothed, and lay hold on her and lie with her, and they be found, then the man that lay with her shall give unto the damsel's father 50 shekels, and she shall be his wife. He's humbled her. He may not put her away all his days. So there's that passage. Then I was talking to Greg Nix earlier this morning, and And he mentioned to me Leviticus 18, verse 29. Then all of these sins that might happen, say with incest, and all of these sins in Leviticus 18, verse 29, the soul should be cut off from among your people. So maybe there would be things that should be done to Amnon besides the death penalty. Again, when I look at Deuteronomy 22, it talks about the death penalty for the one betrothed, not the one who's a virgin. So do I really understand all that's going on in the application of Old Testament law? And in, I'm sorry. In Deuteronomy 17, in verse 6, at the mouth of two witnesses, or three witnesses, shall he that is worthy of death be put to death. But at the mouth of one witness, he shall not be put to death. You know, I don't know necessarily all of the application of Old Testament law regarding the death penalty, being a soul being cut off. Here's the things about betrothed or not betrothed, or incest and not marrying a sister or whatever. There are some things we could say. We see a great difference between Amnon's attitude and David's attitude when they sinned. When Nathan approached David, he turned. Amnon continues on in his attitude. That is one thing we can say. But one point that I can describe in detail, thank you very much. One point that we can mention and stress is that, as we saw earlier, the sword shall not depart from your house. So here we see events building that point to a consequence of David's action and how the sword would not depart from his house. I don't know maybe all the ins and outs, again, about Old Testament law, but if you have a comment on that, I'd welcome your point. Okay, and that's my point. I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, I'm not either, but I just think about Absalom. Absalom's guilty of vigilantism, and that, you know, he's trying to take the law into his own hands.
Okay.
And there's a lesson in here about that, what Absalom did, get revenge on Amnon.
Okay. Right. Okay. Okay. And so, and we'll see that event in just a little bit about how that Absalom takes out his vengeance upon Amnon. Again, and I'm just questioning and wondering about the proper application of Old Testament law here in these cases, and looking at what actually did happen. In verses 23 to 29, after 2 years, Absalom invited the king and all of his king's sons to Baal Hazor and Ephraim for a celebration. They were going to have a sheep shearing, and here's a celebration. And David didn't want to burden Absalom, and he wouldn't go. But due to Absalom's pressure, David let his sons go, including Amnon. And Absalom directed his servants to kill Amnon. After Amnon, his heart was merry with wine, he said, "Slay Amnon," just as he had planned. And then in verse 32, chapter 13 and verse 32, you know, David got word that all of his sons had been killed. But Jonadab said, "Let not my lord suppose that they have slain all the young men, the king's sons, but Amnon only is dead. For by the appointment of Absalom, this hath been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar." So Absalom had it in his heart and planned to destroy Amnon. So David was corrected in his understanding of who had died in this case. And then in the last section of chapter 13, verses 37 through 39, Absalom flees to Syria. It says in verse 37, Absalom fled, went to Talmai, the son of Amiad, king of Geshur, and David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom fled, went to Geshur, and was there 3 years. And the soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead. So why didn't Absalom and his servants face judgment for their murder? I'm not sure. You know, sometimes people mention, you know, David's sin. Well, David sinned, and so then here's Absalom's sin, and so maybe David didn't feel qualified to deal with that. One thing I think consider about that point is, and I'll mention this again in the applications, but in Psalm 51, verse 13, after David was forgiven, it says that he would teach transgressors God's ways. So David confessed his sin, he was forgiven. Then he said in Psalm 51, I'll teach transgressors your ways. I don't know, but here again, here's what I know for sure. Here's something that I do know for sure about why Amnon or Absalom didn't come to justice and his cohorts. I don't know for sure. Here's something I know for sure. The sword shall never depart from your house, David. And that's the application we see. God's sentence came true. The sword, David, the sword's not going to depart from your house. You despised me. You gave occasion for the enemies of God to blaspheme. You're going to face consequences for your sin. And one of the applications we'll see in just a moment is that, you know, we may not be able to change the consequences. Consequences of sin are great, can be great. In chapter 14, Joab, in verse 1, the son of Zeruiah perceived that the king's heart was toward Absalom. We saw there a moment ago that his David's heart longed for his son Absalom. Joab sent to Tekoa, fetched thence a wise woman, said to her, I pray thee, feign thyself to be a mourner. Put on new mourning apparel. Put on now mourning apparel. And anoint not thyself with oil, but be as a woman that hath long time mourned for the dead. And come to the king, speak on this manner to him. So Joab put the words in her mouth. So he sees David mourning for his son. He says, I've got an idea. I've got a plan. So he gets this woman to come and to help with the plan. And he tells the woman, here's what you need to say. Act as if you have two sons. One of the sons killed the other. And then all of the family want to take vengeance, be avengers of blood, and bring this remaining son to justice. And she says, David, you know, I don't want that to happen. I don't want my husband's name to vanish from the earth. You know, can you save my son? Can you help me, David? And so David said he would. In verse 11, he said, then she said, I pray thee, let the king remember the Lord thy God, if thou wouldest not suffer the avengers of blood to destroy any more, lest they destroy my son. And he said, as the Lord liveth, there shall not one hair of thy son fall to the earth. So David was following along with his story. You remember, it's kind of like Nathan coming to David earlier. He gives David a story about the poor man with a lamb, and then the rich man steals the poor man's lamb. And David's getting into the story. So he's getting into this story here with this woman. And he says, I'll help you. You know, your son, that remaining son that killed the other, you know, the avengers of blood, they won't get him. I'll protect him. You can be assured of that. Again, I'm not clear myself on the application of Old Testament law in this case. Could there be in David's mind, could there have been a question about the witnesses? Well, you don't have witnesses or whatever, and that maybe there's the bring him to the elders, but I'll go ahead and give you protection or whatever. I don't know all of the ins and outs. I don't know what was going through David's mind. All we have is what's written. And maybe the point we need to make is the point that we can make, that the sword, David, the sword's not going to depart from your house. Things that we can know for sure. In verse 13, the woman's point is, David, you know, if you were going to spare my son, why don't you spare yours? Why don't you bring your son back? And then so David asked her, did Joab put you up to this, woman? In verse 21, chapter 14, in verse 21, the king said unto Joab, behold, now I have done this thing. Go therefore, bring the young man Absalom back again. So David gets the point. He calls Joab in. He says, Joab, okay, I'll grant you your wish. Go call my son Absalom back. So Absalom had fled for 3 years. David brought him back, and David didn't see him for another 2 years. So he said, yeah, bring him back, but I'm not going to see his face. Here's some applications I'd like us to look at. And before we look at some, before we go into these applications, any comments or questions you have? There's some things I'd like us to reflect on in our study. The way of the I'll just go through these just quickly. But the way of the transgressor is hard. Proverbs 13, verse 15. Amnon's way was hard. Absalom's way was hard. Our sins will find us out. If not now, they will in judgment. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 14. God will bring every work into judgment. We'll face our sins. Flee fornication. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18. Remember Joseph, the good example of Joseph? Flee fornication. The need for self-control. 2 Peter 1, verse 6. One of the virtues. Proverbs 16, verse 32, the one who can rule his spirit is greater than the one who would take a city. Have self-control, develop self-control. Another lesson, the effects of a parent's evil influence on their children are great. The effects of a parent's good influence on their children are great. Another application, evil companions corrupt good morals. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33. In Matthew 15, verse 14, if the blind follow the blind, if the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch. Evil companions corrupt good morals. But what I'd like us to do for a moment is not only see that point. Here's this evil companion over here. Watch out for him. But as you might say, as we're pointing our finger to him, don't forget the three fingers pointing back at ourselves. Think about some things that we need to remember. Number one, do we love the truth? You know, when we're wrestling with something, we can find people who agree with us, people who disagree with us. But do we love the truth? Are we searching the scriptures to see whether the things that we hear from our advisors, good or bad, are true or not? Acts 17, verse 11, the Bereans were noble in that they searched, even searched out what the Apostle Paul told them to see whether that was true. And so, and then are we willing to follow the truth even if we don't like it? Yeah, so we need to watch out for those bad advisors. But when we're looking for what is right, we can find people who agree with us. We can find people that we might want to fight that disagree with us. But do we truly love the truth? And Steve's lesson this morning on the radio, we need to love the truth. We need to look at the scriptures and then follow it even if we don't agree with it. Receive, James 1, verse 21, receive with meekness the engrafted word. On the consequences of sin, they may be permanent. We may not be able to change them. We can still repent. We can still do right, and God still loves us. Study the Old Testament story carefully. And just something I was thinking about in this study and looking at passages, you know, someone says, well, this passage teaches the death penalty. And I look at it, well, that one doesn't. You know, just make sure that we have all the facts. Look at the Old Testament story carefully. And also, and lastly, the need for objectivity and impartiality in applying the law of God to our lives. God's not a respecter of persons, and he's going to judge accordingly. 1 Peter 1, verse 17. We want to see God's truth now, before the judgment. He's not going to respect us. He's not going to respect persons. We'll face our sins. The Word of God applies to us. It applies to our family. We need to weigh the accusation and see whether it's true or not. And then after we've turned, we can then teach transgressors God's ways. Matthew 7, verse 5. Pull the beam out of our own eye, then we'll see clearly. Take the mote out of our brother's eye. Any closing comments you have? Well, thank you for your participation. Oh, one more thing. Next lesson, 2 Samuel 14, the remaining part of 14 through chapter 15.